I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
Great to be here, as always.
Well, Martin, I found myself out with my two eldest granddaughters last night. One of them a student at Notre Dame University and the other at UWA. The conversation inevitably got onto what's going on in Canberra. Long way from Fremantle, but not really in this digital age. We've all been waiting for it. Last week we talked about it. I confidently predicted that Andrew Hastie within 2 weeks would be the leader of the Libs. Is it looking more likely, Martin?
I think that still the leadership change is pretty likely. There are some people that, a lot of people will see that the ditching of net zero, which we'll discuss in a sec, as trying to save Suzanne Ley's leadership. But I don't think it's actually going to do that. It'll probably, these things just tend to probably embolden her critics. And her own moderates, the people that helped put her in place, will be pretty disappointed by the outcome. So I think that the stalking horses are still there, and it's not just Andrew Hastie. There's one or two others that wouldn't mind a crack too.
Well, very interestingly, interesting to see that Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie shoulder to shoulder like a couple of front row forwards in rugby marched into the party meeting. I mean, it's a pretty traditional thing to do. It's a bit of theatre, but it's also quite real, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it was not just them. I think it was a group of, someone will point me out, I'm wrong, 20, 25 MPs, I reckon, that was in that group, often described as conservatives, all marching in together, looking very relaxed, confident of themselves. That's the theatre, Michael. It's, we're going to battle. We think we've got this one stitched up and, we've got the numbers.
Well, I mean, the leadership revolves around the question of net zero. The net zero question was the ostensible topic of discussion, but Susan Ley's future just has to be said to be hanging right in the balance. We've only got, a week of Parliament left before they break for Christmas and the New Year.
Yeah, I think that it's very unlikely there'll be anything this side of Christmas, but in the New Year, I mean, the polling numbers are really bad, and I think there's a lot of frustration within the Liberal Party about how things are travelling, and that often does tend to manifest itself on the leadership, which it already is. So you'd think that early in the new year, February was the time of the year when the famous empty chair almost destroyed Tony Abbott's leadership, if you recall. So that can be a time as well when the challenges are up.
Well, we've got a Prime Minister, Albanese, sort of riding high in all of this. We'll talk about the EPBC bill in a moment and where it's got to. But what would you be doing if you were the PM? Or probably more importantly, what would the PM's advisers be telling him to do when he walks into Parliament on the first day? Is it Monday?
I think we know what he'll say, and it's already been mirrored to his in his comments to the media. I think the focus will be entirely on the Liberals, how they're disunited on net zero. He'll cast them as dinosaurs and talk about if they can't govern themselves, they can't govern the country. And I think that'll be where he'll hammer the coalition most of the week.
Will he, like you could imagine a Keating doing if it were a John Hewson on the other side of the table, try to ridicule Susan Ley in some way, or does her femininity immunise her from such attacks or satire?
He'll portray her as weak, and he'll also betray the stalking horses as people that are in it for themselves, of course. And so I think that he'll probably have a field day. It won't just be Albanese. The other senior ministers will do the same. And the Liberals are just trying to see the parliamentary year out, I suspect, and try and reset in the new year. Sometimes that summer window gives you time to go away, rethink how your strategy is, gear up with some new slogans and new focus points. They certainly need it at the moment.
Martin, net zero still hangs there. COP30 still going on. I think Chris Bowen, the climate and energy minister, is due there this week. Josh Wilson, our Fremantle local MP and the assistant minister in those areas, has, I think, just come back. He presented over there. Everyone agrees the consensus seems to have been lost on the Paris Agreement urgency, as we discussed last week. Where does that go? I mean, a lot of people are going to be, as the moderates in the Liberal Party are, disappointed with the Libs taking their foot off the brake. What does it mean for national policy? How does Labor handle that? Is there some sort of growing dissatisfaction with the mantra net zero by 2050?
There is something in this. So, firstly, the international environment's not quite as cozy for Albanese to be walking into, particularly if he's hosting COP next, because major emitters are divided about what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. And Trump's America is certainly not in the business of pushing for high, strong cuts to emissions, are they? So he doesn't have that lining up for him. The other thing is he made the mistake of promising that power prices were coming down and wasn't able to deliver that. So the thing about being in opposition is you can critique and you don't actually have to make things happen yourself. So the opposition will pivot to critiquing the government on power prices. I expect that to be the strong focus. And if the government can't keep power prices down, Michael, I think that there is a vulnerability there. So expect that to be the focus in 26 and beyond.
What about the EPBC bill? This is the one creating a national EPA to regulate, giving the minister broad powers to own the national interest to let all sorts of things happen, probably including coal mines, if you think about it. It's passed the reps, has it? It has to go to the Senate.
Yeah, so they're still waiting on a deal in the Senate for this. I think we might have touched on this before. It's either deal with the Greens and concede to some of their demands about making more robust protections for the environment, or concede to some of the demands that are likely to come from the Liberals if they do decide to negotiate on this, and that will be around industry's needs, around simplifying processes. And it might be that having dealt with net zero, that the Liberals will be more supportive of this. Certainly, industry wants to see this act go through as well. So maybe there's a bit of an opening there. But either way, the strange thing is the government has to negotiate by making it tougher on the environment, tougher for the environment, or tougher for industry. There's not really a you've got to go one way or the other.
What's the timeline on this, Martin? Can we expect something to happen all of a sudden? And
Certainly, the government's very keen to get this done before the end of the year. That's the intention. They don't want it hanging over them. It's certainly capacity for it to be dealt with this year if a compromise can be reached. It probably is a wise idea if they're going to negotiate for either the Greens or Liberals to come to the party this time. The Greens copped a lot from pushing out major reforms too much, perhaps last time around. That was the narrative, at least, that they were susceptible on. I suspect if they're going to deal, they'd probably deal this week.
so it's this week or next year, is it?
Yeah, basically, they're your two options.
Martin, we've on this view from the Roundhouse, as indeed many commentaries on what's going on geopolitically around the world have been. We've been watching the Middle East, Gaza, Israel. We've been watching Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Russia, and everything all around them. We sometimes forget that there are some awful things happening in other parts of the world. I'll just say one word, Sudan. Have you been watching?
Sudan's a horrible mess, and it's been the war there's been in place since 2023, so a similar time frame to the Gazan conflict with Israel. But while the Gazan conflict with Israel has got a lot of press, this particular conflict has slipped under the radar to some degree, and I think that perhaps speaks to how the Middle East garners a lot of attention and the involvement of the West in various aspects of that, whether US being supportive of Israel or Europeans being critical of Israel, etc. Whereas Sudan, because the West has stayed out of that conflict, it slipped below our radar. But there are major players in the Middle East that are invested in this. So you've got basically two factions, two armed factions, kind of separate governments, if you like, the Sudanese Armed Forces and what's called the Rapid Support Forces. They both are vying for supremacy. There's been claims of massive genocide, particularly in Darfur, the western area of Sudan. And The country's in an awful state. At least 150,000, by conservative estimates, of people have fled altogether. Many thousands of people have been massacred, and we just don't see this much in the public domain. But it's a very serious conflict, and the United Emirates, Arab Emirates, have been widely claimed that they're supporting the Rapid Support Forces, and they're probably the mob that's been accused of the worst war crimes. But the Sudanese armed forces are not looking, they've been subject to claims as well. And Turkey is one of their main backers. So these are people, Turkey's in NATO, Michael. The Emirates are a prominent member of the international community, but they are into this, heavily invested in this conflict, it seems too.
Well, one always asks, what are they fighting about? Human beings, you and I, others, not us directly, get sent to war. Some people are quite sure sometimes why they're going to war, but they know that they're there for their nation. What are they fighting about? And what's in it for these other powers?
Part of it is a traditional battle for power. So there was a coup launched in 21 by both of these factions, and they kind of jointly governed for a while before they split, when the government they supported fell. But there's, as usual, Michael, other considerations. Sudan has some of the biggest gold reserves in Africa, and that's said to be part of what this fight is about, and also part of a reason why other countries such as the Emirates are interested in this.
Well, how do you? I mean, you're an international strategist about these things, Martin. Now, I'm not blaming you for this, I hasten to add. But how would you go about trying to break this? I mean, does the UN try to help? Presumably, people like Trump say, I've done enough. I've won the Nobel Peace Prize in more or less. I want you guys to solve this problem. Emirates and Turkey, put your heads in, solve the problem. Is it something like that?
I think that would help, if pressure were put on the countries that are aiding and abetting these different factions to step back. Now, that's easier said than done, because the more that these countries have invested themselves to date in the conflict, the less likely they are to just step back, because they feel that they've already committed a lot of resources to this. But that would make a difference, because in a lot of these conflicts, so in some of the countries in Africa, they are supported by other countries externally, and that actually escalates the conflict. And you can imagine your weapons are much more destructive than more people are dying. So certainly involvement of third party countries doesn't help.
We perhaps should have made clear at the outset that when you look at the geopolitics in relation to Sudan, there's also South Sudan, and they've had their conflicts over time, and I've covered it in the shipping news. But they have their own moments as well. I see the deputy president's been given the sack overnight, but hopefully things hold there. And with a smile on his face, he says, there's some very good South Sudanese footballers in our Australian Football League, Martin. We'll see what happens. But another place which we've sort of got used to not talking about in positive terms, because they had their own civil wars back in the 70s, they crumbled, they fought amongst themselves, leaders got sacked, IS seemed to be around the place, is Syria. And they've got a new leader who looks like he's got quite a bit of charm about him, so much so that he was invited to go to the White House, and he met our mate Trumpy the other day. Why are they such buddies?
This is an extraordinary development, quite extraordinary for those of us that might have followed Syrian politics for some time. This is an individual who was previously aligned with Al Qaeda. His group was basically an Al Qaeda affiliate. It was widely regarded in the West as a terrorist. There was a bounty on his head, a substantial US bounty on his head. And, it was as far away from going to the White House as you could imagine, Michael. And all this changed, obviously, when the Syrian civil war continued. Assad, who was the president of Syria, was heavily criticized by the West for a whole range of human rights atrocities, etc. And so when the new the Syrian rebel factions, of which the current president is a leader, I guess you could say, of sorts, toppled the Assad regime. A lot of people in the West saw this as a good thing and a positive. And so what happens when he became Syrian president? He has declared that he wants to pursue peace and that he wants better relationships across the board, including with the US. Saudi Arabia's brokered that original meeting with Trump. And, Trump's unconventional, Michael. I think that that's an interesting aspect to him. I've got to say, it is a welcome thing for Trump to be interested generally in trying to create peace in different parts of the world. And there's a long way to go for Syria. There's a lot of messiness as a sort of aftermath of that civil war. But seeing a former Al-Qaeda affiliate and wanted man rock up in the White House was quite the sight and quite extraordinary.
I think we head off to Trump, as I think you're doing. There's a lovely bit of press covering what Trump had to say about it, and obviously being questioned about this man's background, Al Qaeda, the bounty on his head, all of that stuff. And Trump put it rather well, I think. This is the bit of Trump that I quite like. He said, "Oh, well, lots of people have had rough times in their lives, and we're all like that. That all happens to all of us, and we get on with things." And I suppose that's about it.
Yeah, well, when it comes to Syria, Tony Abbott actually had a fair quote a few years back where he said, "There's no goodies and baddies, there's only baddies and baddies." Now, by that, I think what he meant, if I can verbal him, is that there's a lot of unsavory things happening in that country. And, the government was doing awful things. The rebels were no, shining knight either. They had some bad, some awful things. And ISIS was, of course, into it up their eyeballs, Michael. But if that country can see peace and then prosperity, we should applaud that. And you've got to make peace in order to do that.
Martin, people often ask me when I run into them out in the street how I keep up with everything that's going on in the world. Of course, he says, tongue in cheek, I'm up at about 3 o'clock every morning checking economic data, the latest media releases from every part of the world and the like. But I did see some data that made me think you would want to crow on the shipping news very loudly about the housing data and the cost of buying properties in Australia, Martin.
Yeah, I don't want to crow because of a poor policy outcome, Michael, but I think we're entitled to say, "I told you so" here. And that's that a number of recent reports have shown that there has been a spike in housing prices, particularly at the bottom end of the market, since the government released its new policy of lowering the deposit that you need for a house. Now, lowering the deposit you need for a house doesn't actually make a house cheaper. It just means that you need less deposit, but you have to borrow more. And all that policy has done, it's not created any new houses itself. Now, the government will say that they've got a separate policy for that, and that's good. But this particular policy has stimulated demand in an already overheated market, where in the area of the market where you don't want to stimulate demand, which is at the bottom of the market for people coming in. So the part that spiked the most in recent housing prices is the bottom end. And that's most unfortunate because you want people to be able to afford to buy a house. And this particular policy has probably done the opposite.
Well, that's all a little bit depressing, Martin. What's going to perk everybody up, though, is when Australia gets over the line against England in the first test being played at Optus Stadium before long. I'm thinking today is the day I go down and get my old Norm O'Neill bat out of the shed, signed by the great West Australian player Keith Slater, who I think played one test for Australia. Not a bad bat. Sort of a good off-spin bowler, really. And get into shape, Martin. You're looking forward to the test.
Oh, absolutely. So this time next week, the Ashes begin. If you're a cricket aficionado, which I'll have to admit I very much am, a cricket tragic, it's going to be fantastic. I love the build up.
Well, Martin, we'll bid each other goodbye and say to all the shippies listening on the view from the roundhouse this morning, we'll see you in a week's time.
We'll see you all then.